Okay, Ward Hewen here today. He's going to speak. Former AA trustee. He's done a lot for the fellowship. Sorry about the background noise. And yeah, it's a pleasure to have Ward here today. I got a recording sent to me a while ago from a member on this group. And yeah. So I hope you enjoy Ward as much as I do, and thank you for everything you've done for this fellowship, sir, and locally, internationally. And that's enough from me. Take as long as you need, sir.
Okay. So, as Mark said, I have been, and for those of you who've heard this before, I apologize, but I gather there's some folks who haven't heard it before, so I will quickly run over how I got involved with this fellowship. It changed my life for the good, but I first started attending open AA meetings in 1985. I'm an ordained Episcopal priest. I've served congregations in Tennessee, which is where I presently live in the family home, retired. But I served congregations here in Florida, Jacksonville, Florida, then Louisville, Kentucky, and you'll hear a little bit about that. And then Buffalo, New York, where it's snowing today. And then for 12 years, I was the dean and president of the General Theological Seminary in New York City. In 03, I believe, I was elected a trustee from AA. I'd been involved with the fellowship at that point since 75, so 28 years. And then in 09, I was elected chair of the board. So, and then that's a four-year term, and then we rotate. But I continue to attend board meetings as the trustee emeritus and still find this fellowship life-giving. So it's, and I have a little group that I helped start here in East Tennessee. I'm in a very rural county. We have no doctors in the whole county. We have two elementary schools and one high school. And there was only one AA meeting, and some people came to me and said, you ought to start a meeting. And I said, I'm not a member. I'm a non-alcoholic. Y'all don't let me give money. You don't let me be a part of this. And they said, you start a meeting. And so a couple of us went to a local church and we began a meeting, and I still go there. Not every week. I think it's inappropriate for a non-alcoholic to be there every week. But it's my group. I love them. They love me. They accept me. And it, I'll share a little bit about that little group. It's small. We are in a very rural, less than 10,000 people in this county. So it's second smallest county in Tennessee. But let me try to quickly run over this and then get to what I think is the topic I really want to talk about, which is spirituality and religion. And that's probably the topic I'm best equipped to talk about. My early years, before 75, I was an incredibly helpful, not helpful, an incredibly good enabler. I would get phone calls at 1 o'clock in the morning from people who were struggling with their wives and their husbands or upset about this or that. And I would get dressed and go visit, and we would sit down and have a glass of wine or two and talk about their problems. And I was going to help them feel better. And I did help them feel better. So the next morning, they didn't worry about how much they'd had to drink. In fact, they may not have worried about much at all. Sometimes they didn't even remember that I'd come. And I was, like most clergy, absolutely ignorant and wanted to be helpful. Clergy are a funny bunch. And if any of y'all are involved with churches, I would plead for you to be helpful to your clergy. The clergy want to help people. They don't know anything about this illness, which means they're going to do all the wrong things. There's a curious statistic that about 60% of the clergy are children of alcoholics. I saw somebody from England. The Archbishop of Canterbury is very open about the fact that his mother was an alcoholic. And I think has done a great deal for the church. So add ACOA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, to a desire to be helpful, to a desire to be good, and you've got a mess of a human being. And the clergy need your help. They need to understand that life is not about being perfect and understanding all things. But we'll get back to we can do some of that in the Q&A if you'd like. So in Louisville, I moved to Louisville in 1975, a very small congregation, and came to understand quickly that many in the congregation were suffering from drinking problems, as I would have called them. And I said, I don't know anything about this. I don't even know that it's a disease. So I started attending, went to the experts, and began attending open AA meetings. And some of you may remember those days, smoking meetings. If you sat in the back, you could hardly see the speaker for the smoke in the small basement room we tended to meet in. 5 years later, and I attended some courses and instruction at the University of Louisville and was beginning to be informed. And 5 years later, Willie, who was a member of the parish, who had 7 years sobriety, who knew that we knew each other in terms of the fellowship as well as the church. And he walked into my office and said, Ward, you're the spiritual expert, right? I was smart enough to know not to answer that. And he said, I am out of touch with my higher power. The last time I was out of touch with God, I drank. And if I drink again, I may die. I need you to put me back in touch with God. And I was smart enough to know that I couldn't do that. And so we talked a couple of times and decided that what we needed was the experience from the fellowship. And we set up a group. It was five or six people. It varied over the years. For the next 5 years, I met every Tuesday afternoon with this group of people who wanted to talk about the spiritual issues in their life. And that's what changed my life. That's where I really learned the steps, began to work the steps. Willie became my first sponsor. And it was transforming. And I think at least a terribly important piece of that, excuse me, is rigorous honesty. As I said, congregations don't want clergy to be honest. They want clergy to be good. And those two things are not always synonymous. They want clergy to, and if they're not good, they don't want to hear about it. If a clergy's having doubts, they don't want to hear about it. If a clergy person is lazy, they don't want to hear about it. They want to hear only the expectations of a devoted and wonderful human being. That's a hard place to live. That's a very hard place to live. And it's not that we have so many horrible thoughts or awful, awful actions. It's that we're not allowed to share those. And it's within this little group of alcoholics. They didn't care what I thought, what I felt, what I had done, as long as I was truthful about it, that I would seek to be honest. And that's all that really mattered. And I think it hit me especially where I needed help. My teen years were pretty horrendous. I was a super achiever. And somehow, as I look back at it today, it substituted achievement for love. And I felt correctly, I think, that no one knew me. I felt absolutely isolated. The image I had of my life was that I was standing on a very small pyramid pedestal, and everybody below was below and applauding me for all the wonderful things I was doing. And I couldn't get off of it. I couldn't step off it. So I thought a lot about suicide. I never attempted suicide, but I thought a lot about it because I was absolutely alone and ironically felt absolutely worthless. It was actually through the church that I discovered that I am a beloved human being. That was a long journey, still going. And then it was in AA where this rigorous honesty, because I would lie. You know, if you want to be perfect, you're in trouble. Practically, I used to say I was a practically perfect teenager. That's a terrible thing to be. And if you want to be that, you're going to lie. So if somebody says, well, how much do you weigh? Well, I'll tell them 180 if I think that's a good number, when in fact I may weigh 190. It's just an automatic response of something that somehow makes me look better. And suddenly I was in a group where I didn't have, I don't remember numbers. So if I quote numbers to you, I'm just making them up. And my wife goes around and tells everybody that. She tells them that, you know, if he gets in a debate with you and he starts quoting numbers, you got to know he's just making those up. He does not remember numbers, and he will not. So that's the kind of human being you're looking at here. And this fellowship doesn't care about that, except that it wants me to be as honest as I possibly can. And that is so freeing. That is the most freeing thing that happened in my life. I give you thanks for that. I have such gratitude. Every day I have to tell myself rigorous honesty, rigorous honesty, rigorous honesty. But I'm able to live that in a way that I never was able to live it before I became involved with this fellowship. I also learned in that little group, we met for 5 years from 1980 to 1985. I learned in that little group that the only person I could fix was myself. There's really no way to fix somebody else. And by the way, I need help even to do that. And so that little group became a group that helped me grow spiritually and emotionally and personally. That really, really, really changed my life. I couldn't fix myself. I've been spending all those years trying to be practically perfect and discovered I can't do that. It's an impossible task. So let go, get help. One of the definitions of humility that I learned from you, actually, I learned it at the We Agnostics and Atheist Agnostics and Freethinkers in AA, that the definition of humility is the recognition that you need help and the ability to ask for it. Isn't that good? Y'all gave me that definition. I never read it in the church. We're supposed to talk about humility. But the only person that I can fix, and that's difficult, is myself. And the only way that can happen is by getting help. Harry Thibault, who was the psychologist who was the first endorser of Bill Wilson and the steps and the AA, would say a spiritual experience is the act of giving up reliance on one's own omnipotence. The spiritual experience is the act of giving up reliance on one's own omnipotence. I love that definition. I love it. I learned also in that little group that the most important tool that I have to help others is listening. Listening is a very powerful. We do a lot of listening in AA. People outside the fellowship think about the speakers and CAA as a speaker, as something we're speaking. Everybody else is listening. And when I am a part of a discussion group, the listening is so important, and the lack of crosstalk and how we build that relationship is freeing. It's very powerful. I also learned to accept that I could not intervene in this disease for others. Not only was I the only person I could fix, I couldn't really fix others. I've learned to embrace my incompetence. So for somebody who wanted to be practically perfect, who believed in being omnicompetent, I've finally learned to embrace my incompetence. And one of the places is where there's somebody who's got a drinking problem. Hi, Mary. I learned that I couldn't do that. I could not go to the family and talk to them about this disease and help them get into Al-Anon or AA or NA. Because all of my conversation was at the head. I haven't been there. I did not have a story to share. And the way we share our spirituality is by sharing our stories. And I did not have a story that connected to them. And I had two people. One of them drunk ran his car into my car. I went to see him. Another one ran off the road right in front of me. I helped him get out of the car and took him home and met with he and his wife. And I was totally ineffective because I was talking about the disease, that there is a solution, that you can get help. But I did not have a story to share of what it had been like and what happened and what it's like now. So I learned that if I run into those kind of situations, what I have to do was to call a friend of mine in the fellowship, and together we would go and visit the person. So, and I would get a lot of calls like that as an ordained minister. And we got pretty good at it. I not always successful, but often, because I had enough sense that I was incompetent to do that myself. After I left Louisville, just to how important that group was to me, I needed a support group. And I think that's a good thing for all professionals to have some kind of support group. And I tried to put together a clergy support group. And I discovered that if it was just clergy, we did not reach the depth of sharing that would happen when there was a member of the fellowship in it. So I began to always have recruited into my support group a priest who was also a member of this fellowship. And it would change the nature of that whole group. It was fabulous what y'all could what a difference that can make. I guess part of this is for me to say, as members of the fellowship, you have great gifts to give our world. And I would encourage you to talk to your doctor, to your lawyer, to your clergy, and be clear to them about your story. And if you can be of help to them in some way, you'll find out in the first 3 minutes of the conversation, if they're open to a real conversation and a real working together, and it will make a difference for them and for those that they have to deal with. So, embracing my incompetence, spirituality and religion. I really, where I am today on that has come out of my a kind of a dialogue between my own background in the church and my participation in the fellowship. The whole issue of spirituality and religion first arose in a forum in Western Canada, where I was asked the question, do you find a problem by being an ordained minister in AA? And I was surprised by the question. I mean, I didn't think there was any problem at all, but I realized, then I began to hear that many in this fellowship have been judged because they do not have a belief in a traditional God. I found that really difficult to understand. The third tradition is clear. There's one criteria for membership. And yet, as I listened and talked with people, I discovered that there was deep hurt among many people who were told, if you don't believe in God, you'll never get sober. I know too many people who have 40 years sobriety and don't believe in God to believe that statement for a minute. I also heard versions of people's belief in God that I couldn't believe either. It all became kind of messy. So then I was asked to share at the board weekend on the third tradition. And I wrote a little paper, which was later revised and published in the Grapevine, about there's one criteria for membership, and it does not matter if you are atheist, agnostic, believing Christian, Buddhist, Jewish, whatever, you're welcome if you have the desire to stop drinking. That's all that's needed. It became an issue, and I guess it's still somewhat, though I'm pleased to see secular AA growing, free thinkers meetings growing, because we've got to accept and welcome all people into this fellowship. And I became known ultimately in the fellowship as the preacher who didn't like to have the Lord's Prayer at open AA meetings. New people coming in rarely have a good relationship with what they would call God. And when they hear God talk, it can be a real turnoff. And we all know of stories of people who came to AA, were turned off by the God talk, left, but came back and are sober today. What we don't hear are stories of people who came to AA, heard the God talk, were offended, didn't relate to it, left, and didn't come back. And that's a deep concern for me, and I know for many others. There were real Toronto, some of you may know, they were delisted because they had a group that did not, that was openly for people who did not believe, I don't remember the name of the group right now, did not believe in God. Some of you may know Joe C., a good friend of mine, who was a part of that. It's just, I could not understand it. And so I had to begin to reflect and share some of it. Spirituality is at the heart of AA, but we've got to keep religion out. What does that mean? What does that mean for us? And so let me share a little bit of reflection on that, and then we'll have time for Q&A. See where we can go with this. Organized religion. Quickly define religion and spirituality. Religion has a set of beliefs, a core theology. These beliefs are usually in some sort of creed or doctrine that you can read and find out. They often have a run by organized structure, a hierarchy of ordained clergy who represent those who really understand and know the belief system. They have regular regulated styles of worship with set prayers, expectations about sermons. And again, it's largely focused on the ordained leadership. They have a lot of do's and don'ts, and they have clear criteria of whether you're a member or not a member. The thing I object the most, however, about institutionalized religion is its claim that it knows the truth, that it has the truth. And if you don't accept their understanding of truth, then there's something wrong with you. Or in some cases, they simply say quite literally, you can go to hell or will go to hell. Fortunately, if you don't believe in hell, you're okay. Anybody that's studied history of any kind understands that the truth has evolved over the years within the churches. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is Galileo, who was excommunicated from the church because he believed the earth went around the sun instead of the other way around. And through the ages, we've seen those beliefs change and evolve. And to stand up and say, this is the truth, and if you don't believe this, if you don't accept this, something's wrong with you. I don't know how we can do that. My home here in Tennessee is not far from Dayton, Tennessee. I don't know if that rings a bell with any of you. That was the home in 1925 of the Scopes trial, commonly known as the Monkey Trial, when the teacher John Scopes was put on trial for teaching evolution in the school, which was against the law. That's the kind of thing that happens when people decide they know the truth. It's an outside issue. We still regulate teaching and ban books in Tennessee, I'm sorry to say, but that's an outside issue. We won't go there. At its worst, that ends up with witch hunts, crusades. But even at its best, I think we end up with arrogance. And it has this way of spilling into the church, into the fellowship of AA, where if you don't believe in God, you'll never get sober. Fake it till you make it. I'm sure some of you have heard that. In a fellowship that above all else expects rigorous honesty, we're supposed to fake it. I never could quite get there. Never could get there. Okay. Oh, I heard a statement the other day by a member of this fellowship that I love. It said, I have a strong and steadfast faith that comes and goes. I think that expresses my sense. There are days that I have a very strong faith, and then there are days I wonder where it went. But that's okay. Spiritual, on the other hand, is something that's very broad, very inclusive. Everybody has a spirituality. Spirituality is a little like health. You have spirituality. You have health. It may be good health. It may be poor health. You have spirituality. It may be good spirituality, healthy spirituality. It may be a very sick spirituality. And most of you know that there was a spirituality of denial at some point in your life when you were absolutely certain you were not alcoholic. And today there's a spirit that's quite different from that. A healthy spirit of growing in the fellowship, working the steps, getting a sponsor, going to meetings. And that's how that's changed your life. Those are spiritual things that have happened. Spiritual things are those things we cannot see that affect us. Love, hate, anger, joy, serenity, contentment, anxiety. All of those things are invisible, but they affect who we are and how we operate. And how we relate to those things, too. There are really kind of three factors involved in the development of a person's spirituality. One is perception. How do I see things? One is feelings, how I feel about things. And if I feel good about something, I will see it in one way. If I don't feel good about something, I will see it in a different way. So those two things get intersected. And then there are choices that we make. And those choices will affect how we perceive and how we feel. And it's the interaction of these three factors that sort of you end up with, well, that's just what Joe does. Joe's like that. That's Joe's spirituality. That's what we're talking about, is his spirituality. The big book's very clear that spirituality, unlike religion, is not a theory, not a theology, but it's something you have to live. And that's a mystery, but it's not all that common. You just have to live it. And when you live it, your life will be transformed. Our secular world, I think, sometimes makes a couple of mistakes about spirituality that confuse things. First of all, they often tend to equate spirituality and religion. And what I'm trying to say is those two are very different things. There can be a healthy spirituality within a particular faith. There can be an unhealthy spirituality within the particular faith. The spirit of judgment is not a healthy spirituality, and yet it exists in, it's distinct from religion. And we need to keep that separate. The other is this tendency, spirituality is some sort of loosey-goosey experience that with candles, and I don't know, it's not my thing, so I don't know. Otherworldliness, occult, spooky stuff, or godliness and piety, and those have a spirituality, but spirituality is something different, it's distinct from. And when secular world sees only spirituality as some sort of substitute, some sort of equation with religion, or some sort of special spooky unrelated to life experiences, then I think that we tend in the secular world to dismiss the power of spirituality. And what we really need is to understand more clearly a kind of secular spirituality. I just published a book on 12 steps to religionless spirituality. That's what I'm looking for in our world today, in our secular world, where the kind of way the churches run things is not working. We need a secular spirituality, a religionless spirituality, where people can work on their spiritual growth and development, where we can become more fully human, become more fully who we are, become more loving, become more serving to others. We need that, but it doesn't have to be connected to religion. It can be separate, as people in this fellowship know. So quickly, I will survey some of the aspects of the power of spirituality in the steps and in the fellowship. And the most obvious one is meetings. We have meetings. When Hurricane Sandy hit New York, that was the weekend that we had our board meeting, and we had an international, the international meeting of AA. And the people had come from all over the world. They were there that week. Then they stayed for the board meeting. Then Sandy hit and nobody could get away. And they were stuck in a hotel in Westchester, no electricity. And the work crews that came in to restore the electricity and get things back together were also in that hotel. And it was, I think, the second night that somebody walked in, one of the people who had been out all day in the rain and in the cold and in the wind and trying to repair the electrical structures, was tired, hungry, and angry. And he was ranting and raving. And finally, he looked at these people who were sitting around and he said, "What the hell are you doing here anyway?" And one of them said, "Well, we're members of AA. We were here for the board meeting and we can't get out and we're stuck here." And the man stopped and looked at him and said, "I could use a meeting today. I could use a meeting right now." So they got candles, they got the book, and they held a meeting. And after it was over, he was much more relaxed and himself than he had been when he walked in. That's what meetings do. They change us. They change us. There's a power in the meeting that's not true in a one-on-one, certainly not true on walking in the woods by yourself, though I think those are, excuse me, are good and important practices. But what is really important is that meeting, that group, that caring. And I think this is partly because of Joe, just saw you. That meetings have a inner nature that's spiritual. So all groups have an outer and an inner nature. There is a member. Okay, let's take a football team. We're in the middle of football season. You can say who the members of the football team are, who the coaches are, what the things are. But there is also within that a team, an esprit de corps, a spirit, a culture that will change it. Anybody that's played sports knows there are times when a team is up and the results actually exceed the norm. And then there are times when a team is down and they make mistakes that they wonder how in the world could they have made those. And that's that inner spirit that makes a difference in how people react. A coach's job is not only to recruit the best players, it's to produce a spirit, a culture within the team that will produce the best performance. And to some extent, that's AA has a culture within it. And in my experience, that culture includes acceptance of anybody who walks in who has a desire to stop drinking. It has a criteria of rigorous honesty. It calls for truthfulness and accountability of the members. There is a deep love among the membership, even though we may be very, very different. It's good in many ways. And there is a gratitude that I have learned from this fellowship that's really, really amazing. A sense of real gratitude that the gifts that life has given us. Those things are there, whether one has a belief in God or not, because that is the spirit of that group. The spirit of the group changes the behavior, perception, and actions of the members. A funny kind of story about a little five-year-old girl whose parents were in the neighborhood, and the lot next door was vacant. And then some people came to build a house on the lot next door. And of course, a five-year-old really interested in this. And she is watching, and the workmen kind of adopt her as a mascot, I guess. And they give her little jobs to do, like picking up, you know, when you saw in two before, she ended up with little pieces all over the ground, and she'd go around and pick those up and put them in the can to be burned. And then they got her to pick up some nails around. And then they said, you know, and she would sit down with him at lunchtime and sit with him at breaks and talk to him, listen to him. And they said, you know what we ought to do is we ought to give her a check. She's working for us. So they got the company to write a check, put it in the official envelope for $10, and gave it to her for her work at the construction site. And her mother said, well, let's open a bank account with that. That'll be a really great thing for you to do. So they go to the bank, they deposit the money, and the teller there says, so how did you earn this money? She said, well, I'm working on a construction team. And the teller says, well, are you going to be doing that again next week? She said, well, if the assholes at Lowe's ever deliver the damn drywall, I will. When you're in a culture, that culture will affect how you perceive things, how you respond, how you make choices. My administrative assistant at Trinity Church Buffalo, used to come into my office every once in a while and say, Ward, there are four ways to do things. There's a right way. There's a wrong way. There's your way, and there's the Trinity way. On this project, I would suggest we do it the Trinity way, because there's a culture, and either you're going to fight the culture or you're going to work with it and have it spread. That culture is a significant power in the lives of every member who's a part of that group. Many in AA, I think, like to refer to that as God. Many would prefer to refer to it as an esprit de corps, the culture. Business practice talks about culture of a business, which influences how people work. So I think the place we begin in looking at the spirituality of this fellowship is at the meetings of the fellowship. Other things include rigorous honesty, as I've already said, how important that was in my life. Story. We share our story. That's such a powerful tool. It's the way the spirituality gets shared. You don't share spirituality by sharing your thoughts in your head. Those are philosophy. You share spirituality when you share your story. And this little group that I go to up here in Tennessee, I remember John, who was assigned to attend AA and came in, and we had to sign his slip. And he never said a word. He came in, he sat through the meeting, he got his slip signed, he left. That went on for several weeks. And then as we shared, people would go around, I'm Joe, I'm an alcoholic. I'm Mary, I'm an alcoholic. I'm Joan, I'm an alcoholic. I'm Ward, I'm a friend of AA. And we would share something. John passed. And it had been about 6 or 8 weeks, maybe longer, when one day he said, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. That was it. And everybody in the group knew that we had hit a major point of transformation. And it was not long before John began to share something of his story. And I remember he was a speaker at a larger meeting. And I went because I wanted to hear him. And he shared his story and the craziness that he was involved in, the hurts, the pain, the healing that was going on, what had happened to his relationships. And I thought, man, this is such a different human being from John, who first arrived at our little group. When we share our story, that's how we build our identity. Somebody asks you, who are you? You're going to tell them the story if you really want to share who you are. By sharing our story, we actually create our identity. And when we begin to say, I'm an alcoholic, that's it. I've now got a new identity. And as I share that story and tell some of the details, I embrace pieces of the past, and I recognize that pieces need to be let go, and I'm slowly form a new person through this power of storytelling. There's some research going on these days about that that's really quite exciting, but it's been going on in AA for 80 years. And more than just the individual identity, that group identity comes from that sharing of stories and the commonality. We're all different, but there's a commonality that runs through the stories that is a part of what sets that spirit of AA, that culture of AA, that is looking for honesty, that's looking for growth, that's looking for change, that involves itself in service. Well, I'm going to have time for Q&A, so I'm going to jump real quick here from service is another piece of the spirituality of this fellowship. I know you all know when you get a call and somebody, you need to do a 12-step call, you don't have any idea whether that's going to be successful or not, but you do it. Martin Luther King, toward the end of his life, was asked if he was optimistic, and he said, no, I'm not optimistic, but I'm hopeful. And I thought, boy, does that ever explain the 12-step call. You're hopeful because you've seen the transformation that can happen. And maybe it'll happen this time. And so we do it. So you do it. All that and more represent the spirituality of AA. And that spirituality is powerful and it transforms lives. And all of you know that that's a truth. My experience is that believers, non-believers, theists, atheists, agnostics, free thinkers, Christians, Jews, Buddhists, all can share a common experience. And that experience is the commonality we have, and that's where we can carry on the dialogue. And we need to learn to be humble about our beliefs. We know so little. Again, another area of research that I'm not going to try to touch right now. You can get it in my book, is about how little we know. Ultimately, we do not know with certainty most of what we operate on. We have experience. We commit to it. We live it. We get corrections, but we do not know it to give it to somebody else. To develop a kind of humility about that is so important. And instead, by sharing experience, we can share our own spirituality. We can share the power of this fellowship. We can share your experience and listen to the others. And guess what? Change will happen. It's exciting. Let me say, I think I need to be rigorously honest and say this program continues to change and support my life. When I was at Trinity Buffalo, we had a fabulous education program. It was nationally recognized, and we were running a fabulous program. My successor literally sabotaged the program and ended up within 6 months ending it. Easy to get resentment. You taught me that resentment is only going to hurt me. You taught me to let it go, that no matter how unhappy I am about it, there are others who can learn from my experience. I need to be able to talk about it, but not with resentment, but in a sharing way that allows others to understand and to benefit from that experience. The same actually happened from my time at General Seminary. We put together a fabulous program. We were fully enrolled. We were $30 million in debt, having developed a conference facility named for Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who was a friend of the seminary and became a personal friend. When I left, a small group on the board decided the $30 million was a disaster and began selling property. Today, the seminary is basically closed. Easy to get resentment. I have to remind myself that I did a good job and let it go. Because if I get resentful, there's only one person that's going to really hurt, and you're looking at him. You've taught me that. It's a hard lesson. But it's this spirituality that has allowed me to do that. And I think I've done a pretty good job of it. I'm sure there are days when I may speak in anger, but most of the time it's just that that's what happens. And because you've done a good job does not mean you have control on everybody else. 3 weeks ago, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. That one, it threw me. I've been very healthy all of my life, and I was not expecting it. I mean, I was doing tests, but why would that mean? Do you know about denial? Okay, it was a shock. And for a couple of days, I was kind of wandering around in a daze. And everybody's telling me about the medications today are much better, and the therapy they use is better and everything, and it's not going to affect you. And that didn't affect me. That's all head stuff. And then in my morning quiet, I said, I'm doing okay today. Today's good. I'm feeling good. Nothing wrong. And I said, that's what I need to be doing. I need to be just living this one day at a time. It'll evolve. I don't have any controls. I can do my exercises. I can take my pills. But today I'm fine. And I can say again right now, today I'm fine. And because I'm willing to open up and talk about it, it has less power over me. Those first couple of days, I didn't tell anybody, and it consumed me. This fellowship taught me how to do that. And I thank you. I have deep, deep gratitude for what you have given to me. Thank you so much. And let's have some Q&A. So somebody needs to run this.
Okay. Thank you, Ward. That'll be Derek in a second.
Okay.
Thank you so much for coming today, man. And I did take notes. I love what you said about spirituality. And I'm sorry, I started chatting halfway through your talk because I haven't seen my friend in ages, but I'm really delighted I can listen back to it. Yeah, you said an outside issue. And there's a member of our group that once said that if it affects this alcoholic, it's not an outside issue. So,
Well, if it in relationship to the drinking, yes.
I don't know.
But the Tennessee legislature is an outside issue. It doesn't make me drink.
Well, I'll have a look at it and I'll see how good you are. And I like that one comment you said where you can't fix other people. That's the truth. And I don't believe in anything either, truth be told, Ward, but I do like lighting a candle for someone. And and there's a thing I heard from a wrestler before, and it's to do with religion, wrestling, everything. It's like, for those who don't believe, no explanation will do, and for those who do believe, no explanation is needed. So double J. Oh, actually, I had one thing I wanted to ask you. Do you pray before a big game? That was my one question.
Oh, somebody else asked me once before how I feel about praying around sports events, and I think it's ridiculous. If God cares about the sport event, I don't know. I have not developed a theology of praying for sports events, and I personally do not. I do pray a lot. It's mostly just conversation, often arguing, often complaining, and occasionally expressing gratitude. But it's conversation that may or may not be heard. I think I could say I'm absolutely convinced that prayer is the most effective thing in the world, but it convention comes and goes.
Towards the end, I always thought anytime I was praying, I was begging, truth be told, like, just give me that new bicycle, that's what I want. Ward, thank you so much again, sir, for all you've done in this and coming today, taking time out. We're going to do raised hands, and first is CJ in Chicago.
Hello, good morning, Ward. My name's Karen. I'm in Chicago. I don't know what non-alcoholic means, but I'd like to, and I have a comment as well. So I'll start with a comment if that's okay. Sure. Well, I am so glad to be here. Everybody who made this happen, I'm so grateful, because I was sleeping and Georgia, who's here, texted me that you'd be here, and I didn't know who you were. So I was like, well, let's check this out. So I'm a therapist, and I used to teach yoga to people with Parkinson's disease. That's a separate thing we can talk about later if you want.
Right. But,
I'm going to share this recording with my group that I practice with. I want them to hear it, because what you said about how groups can be healthy is golden. And I loved that, the spirit of the group. You know, what occurred to me while you were talking is that, as we all know, espiritu or spirits, alcohol, they gave me faith. That was one of the ways I got faith. I got faith by drinking, and then I felt more connected to something good that I couldn't access on my own, you know, and then it stopped working, obviously. Mm-hmm. I only have today's day 31 this time. And something that you said, okay, so I just can't, but like, you know, I'm glad you're around. This book sounds great. Maybe my sponsor will want to use that instead of what we were going to use for our 12-step. She's nodding her head. My history is Catholic, Chicago, Polish, churches everywhere, atheist my whole life. So what you said was very helpful and very encouraging. Also the truth part, I have not been rigorously honest. I pretend to be so much better than I am. I'm a therapist, a yoga teacher, a meditation teacher, a writer. God damn it. Sorry if that offends anybody, but that's like, I write for a blog called Every Goddamn Day. But I'm not even honest on there. You know, I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to do rigorous honesty yet, because I'm too scared of, I feel like the times in my life that I have stood up to bullies or, you know, whatever it is, I've gotten in trouble. I've gotten fired. I've gotten, you know, I'm a middle-aged woman. I don't have a lot of power. So a lot of times when I do speak my truth, it gets shot down, even in the rooms. You know, that's why I mostly stick to women's meetings. And it even happens there. It's like, there's a condescending nature, I think, that's part of the toxic patriarchy. That kept me out of the rooms. You know, I got on my knees and prayed for years. I don't know. I'm going to stop rambling. But what I want to say is, what you said was so helpful. I took notes. I can't wait to share your little ditty this morning with my group. One of my mentors is a pastor, and my boss is a pastor. And I have a lot more questions for you that I'll get together and maybe can ask you another time. But thanks, everybody. I love you all, even though, you know, anyway, I love you. Thank you.
Hi, Edgar, hands up. How are we, sir? And thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for the service, and thank you all of you for the stay here. Thank you, Mr. Ward. My name is Edgar from Mexico, Campeche. Well, hi, everyone. I try to just ask one question. The spirituality word, is a word I don't use. Well, of course, spirituality, I don't use that word, but I always translate that word like awareness. This is the only traduction I can make with that word. So the question is, do you use the word spirituality instead the word awareness or conscious is the same for you, or is this another thing, awareness and spirituality?
Your sound was a bit broken up. I'm not sure I understand the question.
The word spirituality means is equal to awareness.
I'm still having difficulty.
Don't worry. No, awareness, it's okay.
Awareness and spirituality
is the same for you.
It's a little more complicated than just awareness, partly because most of our spirituality is affected by things we're not aware of. But that we have Catholic Chicago. That's going to affect how you perceive things, how you feel about things, choices you make, and you're not particularly aware that it's involved at that point. If that's fair, Karen. And awareness is an incredibly important tool for strengthening and healing one's spirituality. But then I think spirituality is more complex than just awareness.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Edwin. Thank you so much for your sharing. Thank you, all of you. Okay.
Thanks for that, Edgar. Georgia, if you want to come on down and ask your question and to everybody else, this is the Q&A section. Ward, just a quick check. What's your time like? Because this is Tusanua, so things can run over.
I probably want to eat lunch in about 3 hours.
Okay, that's good. So you got loads of time. You're a proper Tusanua member. So, guys, questions for, a reverend here. Come on. You know what I mean? Georgia, over to you.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you to everyone who's made this meeting possible. Georgia, I'm grateful to be in recovery. Reverend Ewing, thank you so much for participating today. My sobriety date is August 24th, 2015. I came in as a straight up atheist. I remain an atheist. And what that means for me is I don't have to believe in anything outside of myself. When it comes to alcoholism, I believe in the group of drunks. They helped me to get sober. They helped me to find me. They helped me to become the woman I never thought I could become. Spirituality for me is, It's kind of an inside job. if I feel loving, if I feel loved, if I feel honest, I feel good inside. When I'm not being honest, I don't feel good inside, and I have to do something about that. It's my conscience, I guess, you know, it's how I feel within myself. It's how I take a breath. It's what my living being is about. And in turn, that projects a better person, that projects a better me to the outside world. I didn't do that before getting sober. When I did come in, I did a lot of research on secular Alcoholics Anonymous. I happened to come across you and your recordings. And thank you for that, because I was totally floored to think that a member of the clergy would be involved as a Class A non-alcoholic in general service and be honest. So I thank you so much. You know, I think what you have done has meant so much to the secular world of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think back in the 1930s, I think they had something. but they weren't willing to go all the way and say, well, you know, we do have to throw a little religion in there. But thank you so much for today.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Georgia. Rose, if you've got some questions for our resident reverend, that'd be great.
I don't know whether it counts as a question. Thank you, Derek, and thank you very much, Ward, for being here. Really, that's what I wanted to say. Thank you for speaking today. I listened to your recording previously, and your description of what spirituality is something that I need to write down and hang on to, because I remember when I heard it the first time thinking, oh, that's what I'm trying to say when I say to people that I'm a spiritual person and not a religious person. And also for me to listen to you today, it's really good. One of the things that I'm sitting with in my head is that I'm going through the Blue Book with my sponsor, and every time it describes the difference between a normal person and an alcoholic, I find myself saying, well, I'm the normal person as described in the Big Book and not an alcoholic. And that makes me cross, actually, because I don't think it's simply falling one side of the line or the other. And maybe it's that I'm in denial. You know, that might come up in my period of time in the fellowship, and things might clarify in different ways. But this idea that we're one thing or another, and I'm thinking, I want a book that says 12 steps for normal people or 12 steps for everyone. You know, I don't want to be excluded because I don't meet Bill W's definition, because I think that 12 steps is really going to help me, and being part of a fellowship and the principles of rigorous honesty and all that are going to help me and could help anybody, not just people who suffer from addiction or whatever. So it's really great to hear somebody say, I don't identify as an addict, but working a 12-step culture in my life has been a positive thing. And that's what I want. I don't want to get stuck in a definition of who I am or what I am.
Right.
I just want to live a 12-step life so that for the what's left of my life can be lived in that sort of positive culture. So thank you. I know it's not a question, Derek. I'm sorry, but I'm just really grateful to hear you. Thanks ever so much.
Thank you, Rose. Part of my hope in this book is that it will be accepted by those outside the fellowship. A lot of folks within the fellowship are looking at it, and I understand some sponsors are using it. I feel sorry for their sponsees. But it is such a gift. It is such a powerful tool. And most folks don't have a clue about it. And it really, one thing that I didn't say, not just because I didn't say it. I translate in my own head every time I read the steps. I'm not fond of God of our understanding. Again, because that's all about head stuff. And so I translate that, and this is probably heresy, in my own head, to God of my experience. And the focus needs, and I have a real commitment to the sense that our focus needs to be on our experience, on our sharing, on our struggle with honesty, on our struggles. And when we do that, and particularly in a group with the culture like AA, we will be transformed into more caring, serving human beings. And again, I can only be grateful for that.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Rose. Mikey, you're next up. I just want to say that obviously this being too senua, if you just want to share, share. If you want to ask Ward a question, ask a question. Totally free spirit. He's got up to 3 hours, he's told us, guys. So this could go on for some time because it's another time of a meeting.
Rigorous honesty. I've got somebody coming to work for me at noon. That's an hour away.
Okay. How far away is that, Ward? Just in case.
Noon.
Noon, 12 o'clock here. Which is 1 hour from now.
1 hour. So, guys, we've got up to a 1 hour until that workman turns up. So please come back and share with Ward or ask him a question. It's an open-ended meeting. Just glad you're here. Hi, Mikey, you're next up. I'm shutting up now.
Hi, my name is Mikey. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here. It's like I'm looking at a celebrity, Ward Ewing. I mean, I've heard all your stuff, and I do have kind of two questions. One is kind of as a former trustee and as a someone who has a good look at Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole, how would you say secular meetings are viewed by AA as a whole? One thing that we get a lot of is, oh, well, that's not real AA, or you're not really sober, or you're not, this is not legitimate. And it kind of makes us feel like outsiders in a group of outsiders. so I was wondering what your opinion on that was. And I have one other question.
Okay. Quickly, I think many in AA look at you with some suspicion. I do not hear that, because they have heard me, because I have been in a position where what I've had to say has been circulated. And I rarely hear anybody say, well, we're not sure these folks can stay sober. I just don't hear it. And my sense, when I go back to the Toronto and the delisting, and there were other delistings around the country, and there've been some other, and before the we Atheists and Agnostics in AA conference, there was a lot of suspicion. And my sense is that's diminished, but I'm not taking a poll. I'm not collecting data, but my impression is people are recognizing that in a secular age, we need to be looking close at a program that seems so oriented around God, and maybe getting a little more tolerant of those who are in a different place. That's my sense.
That leads me to my second question, if I could, would be, given that a lot of focus right now when it comes to anything religious, we're getting a lot of the crazy religion, the outside, far, far extreme religion. And when people find out that AA is religious, that's one big block that is in front of them to get in the door. And a lot of times believers, not necessarily, atheists or agnostics, but just normal people that don't want to be inundated by the religion, will come through a secular door. They'll come through secular AA meetings, not because they're atheist or agnostic, but because they just don't want the giant deluge of religion, and then eventually filter out into real AA, which is not religious. It's not that big scary monster, but they do come in through a secular door. Do you feel that AA should maybe, I don't know, from a program position or any kind of viewpoint, look more at secular AA being helpful as opposed to being a complement to someone's recovery or an alternative?
I think that's happening. I mean, I think that's a part of the diminishing of the suspicion. And I think it's recognizing, and the crazies in religion outside issue are really crazy.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for that, Mikey. Look, guys, I'm just going to admit something's going on with my whatever chat thing. CJ is next. After that, I don't know who's next. So everyone's going to get called. It may not be in the order that you sort of think you should be. That's my fault, because I'm just a useless host. So CJ, if you want to jump in and share or ask a question, the floor is yours.
Okay. All right. Mark had to unmute me. I'm just going to say one quick question. Mark already said I could jump back in and also told me what a non-alcoholic is. So I got that. Here's my question, please. You talked about humility. I don't remember the exact definition, but I'll listen back unless you want to say it. Okay.
Humility is understanding that you need help and being able to ask for it.
Okay. So my question is this. In the rooms, I notice that as a person who has relapsed and come back, a lot of times, not just me, but a lot of newcomers are treated in a very specific way that might not be applicable. For example, we don't know how much they were drinking. We don't know how many years of sobriety they had before. We don't know their story. We don't know if they've worked the steps, you know, but there's like kind of a condescending attitude towards, you know, towards me, towards other newcomers sometimes, which I know for me, the work is not taking it personally, but it's hard sometimes because it kind of makes me want to run, you know, it's just like, it's a little hard to bear sometimes. So I guess I'm asking twofold. One, as a group, how can we protect people from that happening using the principles of humility? And two, as if it happens towards a newcomer, what can we say? Something simple and respectful and kind, but effective to kind of remind people that everybody's kind of an equal in these rooms or something to that effect. Thank you.
I think you do it. And maybe you, I don't know. I mean, every group is different and there are certainly groups that are not healthy. But my experience is, we're glad you're here. Keep coming back. Here's my phone number. Call if you need anything. We're so pleased that you're here. And we look forward to hearing your story. I've seen nothing. And we've had people who've slipped, come to my little group. Now, there are 10 or 12 people in this little group. So you don't get away with not being noticed. And they're just glad you're here. They're just really glad you're here. And that's been my experience. And so I don't know that I can help you much where that's not happening.
All right. Thanks for that. Sarah, you're next up. Hopefully I've got that right. Ellie and Dave, you'll be in that order. So over to you, Sarah, if you want to share or ask a question, floor is yours.
She's muted.
Hello. Hello. Thanks very much, Ward. Sarah, alcoholic. Sorry, I have my camera off because I'm currently have an insane toddler who's jumping off things. So nobody needs to see that. I was really interested in what you had to say about spirituality. Like from my point of view, I always just got very confused when people, you know, I think like, and you were talking about like where you are. And I think like, you know, somewhere in AA in New York City, I think when people talk about spirituality, they could mean absolutely anything. So I've always just kind of shied away from even thinking about it. But I was just having been in an active member of an agnostic and free thinkers AA group for a good few years now, like nearly 5 years, the same group in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. I'm interested in, how do you put this? I'm kind of just curious about like what you feel about like, say like circular AA versus normal AA in terms of like suggestions within AA. I think like, I started off in kind of like normal AA and I still have the same sponsor. I didn't really finish the steps, but I have a sponsee in agnostic AA. And it's kind of like a lot of the suggestions of AA, I go with the take it or leave it approach, where like, it's just a suggestion and they, you know, the only requirements are desire to stop drinking and like the honesty part, you know, to thyself be true. And also, don't drink and go to meetings. That's kind of like the AA philosophy I kind of like go with. But I think having been sober for a few years now, the what you were talking about, I thought, like, what you were saying about resentment in terms of spirituality, I thought was very are you okay, darling? Like what you were saying about spirituality, I thought was really helpful. And I think that my agnostic atheist program, but basically what I'm kind of interested in what you have to say is, what I'm interested in is the suggestions that, like, agnostic AA is very light on suggestions. And say, for example, say when, like, a newcomer comes to the meeting, in a regular AA meeting, you know, you find, like, a bunch of people will, like, try to give phone numbers, where it's like, I think in agnostic AA meetings, people are a little bit more like things to just kind of, like, happen in terms of, like, just having conversations outside of the meeting and things like that. Or then in terms of, like, working the steps, or spirituality, like, because it's confusing for me, I kind of don't tend to do things that are suggested because it's not in the way. I feel like I'm explaining something simple in a really roundabout way, so I apologize. But I mean, I suppose basically to just simplify kind of what I'm saying, this, how do you go about the spirituality side of the suggestions of AA and the steps? Or can you talk about, like, your spiritual practice from a kind of, like, from a non-God point of view? Sorry about the baby. I'm going to stop because this is just too much. But thanks very much.
I think we get a little bit of a danger spot when we start trying to separate secular AA from atheist AA from regular AA. I'm a real believer in the first tradition that unity is essential to recovery. I watch churches have fights over theology, and I think how stupid, but they split. It's been said I'm not going there. But we're together, and we've got to listen, and discover that no matter where someone's coming from, they are sharing a truth and a spiritual experience that we can connect with and that can be helpful. I really have found that my work, my presence with members of atheist and agnostic AA groups has been very growing for me. It's been fabulous. And we just got to stay together. Love and tolerance is our code. And I don't know if I'm answering your question, Rose, exactly, or Sarah. But I think we've got to be really clear that we are one, and that the differences. My personal theology is God is so much bigger than anything we can even conceive of that anybody's idea of God is inadequate, including my own. That's sort of where I am personally. And I don't have any problem with people who look at traditional theology and say, I can't believe that stuff. Because I can't either. It's mystery and experience become central for my life. And I think that's, I don't know, I'm rambling, but unity is really critical to us. And I think listening to each other and not making assumptions about each other is the only way we can do that.
That's right. Ellie, if you want to unmute yourself and come on down. Ellie, have you unmuted?
Yes, I have.
All right, cool. Floor is yours.
I want to thank you very much for your share. It was really special for me. because I've experienced religious trauma in the past. So I found this share very healing in terms of my progress in recovery and my journey in recovery. And I'm an atheist and a free thinker. And I have a concept of spirituality that's very much based on my own inner self, my perceptions, my attitudes, my own inner emotional life. And what I really liked about your share, and in particular, as you've been asking questions of people who are particularly interested in the spiritual concept and how that's expressed, and in AA and the growth of secular AA, and the growth of secular AA I'm very grateful for, because I would not be maintaining my present sobriety, if it wasn't for that. I'm quite sure of it. I would be still on that slow road to suicide or maybe dead. And I noted something in your share when you were talking about storytelling and listening to stories, and that being the essence of meetings. And at different times you've brought an extra person in and it's changed the whole dynamic of the meeting. And people have talked about the dynamics of meetings or the culture, and how we as individuals, or one individual, can change that, or the process of a meeting can change that, the dynamic or style. And I find that diversity. And diversity to me is the essence of growth and survival and thriving and hope. So I see secular AA as providing hope for the future of AA as a whole, because it's diverse. And it reminds me, with your service duties, if the question or what I would like you to respond to is, if you could cast your mind back to Carl Jung, a founder, key founder and thinker in AA, and advisor to Bill Wilson and the Oxford Group. He saw that profound power in one alcoholic sharing with another, and the building of culture, the building of that healing dynamic, that storytelling, that listening, that identification. How do we promote that with that fear and push back in the broader global AA movement?
Yeah.
That's what I would like to ask. Right.
No, I think Bill is very clear, and he points to his meeting with Dr. Bob, that mutuality is the essence of that sharing. And it comes out of a mutual shared pain. That's part of why I always have to, when I talk with AA groups, I need to share something of my own growing up and my own bondage to success and my own looking at suicide, because I don't share the same experience, and therefore there's a certain lack of mutuality. And I recognize that. I understand that. But we all have those times when we've struggled. And it's in sharing those that we find our real connection. I just think secular AA has got to continue working down the trail. I think it's going to, it will affect, I think it is already affecting the structure and meaning of AA. You know, we put England has the God word pamphlet, which I think is quite good. We put out a good pamphlet and gave it a terrible title called Many Paths to Spirituality, as if AA was about spirituality instead of sobriety. I think it's a good pamphlet in terms of sharing a multitude of experiences and spiritual perspectives, but it's a terrible, terrible title because it should be Many Paths to Sobriety. Anyway, I think we just keep at it. I think the unity is going to come and it's going to be different for everybody. That's what happens when you evolve.
Thank you. Dave, if you can unmute yourself and come on down.
There we go. Cheers. It wasn't allowing me to unmute, but I've got it now. Thanks, Derek. Cheers. Thanks, Ward. I've heard you before on one of Joe's podcasts, and I really, really enjoyed it, the dynamic that you've had. It was actually at work, because I'm in a job, I can do that. I've said this before, not regularly, but a lot of people probably know that I love music. Even before I came to recovery, you know, music was a big part of my life, and particularly soul music, you know, and the word spirituality, I suppose, in one of my favourite albums, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, it's threaded all the way through it. You know, fantastic album. And like a lot of people, I didn't get to secular meetings until, I was exploring literature, A Agnostica, fantastic resource. You know, I was exploring that, I was dipping into that. And I think I went to some of Beyond Belief's podcasts and YouTube, and heard the interviews, I think, between John and Angela. But it was only really Zoom meetings that I went to because of COVID. And I'm not saying it's detrimental, but I don't hear much about, you know, the words spiritual or spirituality talked about in secular meetings. And I suppose each to their own. Everybody's got their own definition of whatever language that suits them. For myself, spirituality, or being more spirited, I like that in that context there. And if I'm comparing and contrasting, which is a good thing, I think, to do for myself, I kept everything inside. Shame was my kind of companion. It was my companion for so long. And I see my shyness, acute shyness, was just my companion with shame. Shame was telling me, don't say anything, Dave, don't open up. Don't really express yourself because you're going to be shamed or humiliated, or they won't like what you've got to say. You know, a codependency, that's kind of the labels. And, you know, for me, being a spirited person is somebody who probably owns their truth and then probably speaks it as well, because that's attractive. I think that's what you were saying, the dynamic, the interdependent kind of dynamic that goes on in meetings and sharing that. And for myself, I'm a lot better at it. Because I practice it, I realize the ground never swallows them up. I never burst into flames. It's always okay. If I'm comparing and contrasting, I kept everything small and I kept quiet. And then there was always that illusion that someday things will change, Dave. And that someday never happened until I suppose you had a bit of faith. I had a bit of faith that things would change. And I don't look at that word faith in a religious context at all. It's just trusting and uncertainty. It's just trusting. If I want to get from A to D, then I need to trust there's certain actions that will get me there. But it's not going to happen by magic. And I believe I'm testament to that there. There's so many, many things that I've done since I've been sober. But I've realised, okay, I know I can get there. I might not get the outcome, but generally I might get peace of mind, but I need to put in the effort. I need to put in the footwork. I think that's really good stuff about being sober. If my brain was messed up and mashed up I use the cooking analogies. There is no way that I would be able to process, disseminate information, process it, and then realize, okay, this is what I need to do to get there. You know, because I believe for myself that that talks, it's easy to talk in a meeting, but it's the nitty gritty stuff after the meeting that will make a difference to the substance of my life. For me personally, that's all. So the question, there was two of them actually, but take whichever you ever want. I was going to ask you, what would you change in AA literature that you'd really like to see changed, particularly the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? But more so, go whatever one you want. What three things would you tell somebody who were first in a meeting? What habits, three habits that you would like to see somebody maybe implement in their life that will make a difference, a substantial difference?
Oh, that's easy. Keep coming back, get a sponsor, work the steps. One, two, three. I mean, it works. And that's I join with those who say that's the thing to do. Your first question, you threw me off with an easy answer on the second one. Your first question was,
what changes might you make in the literature, particularly, yeah. Specifically? Yeah.
Okay. I'm an Episcopal priest. Episcopalians deal with the ancient texts because we know you can't take them literally. You have to interpret them. You have to change in your head what you're reading or seeing. I kind of take that approach to the big book in 12 and 12, that I have to read, that I recognize this is a historic document and I have to interpret it myself. I think it's really difficult to change. We are working on a simplified, what is it called? Simplified language edition of the big book. I haven't seen any of it yet. But it's under production, and we'll see what that does. It will cause a stir, I'm sure. We do need to get away from the big book being sacred text and just see it as historical text that has a program that changes lives. And let's focus on experience and mystery and recognize that we're going to interpret it. But I don't know that I would try to edit it. I know I would not try to edit it. That'd be absolutely absurd. I've been happy for y'all to. And I know many of you have edited the steps, and I read those, and I like them because it's a bigger process than just turn my life and my will over to God as I understand it. It's bigger than that, and so if it. We've got to put it in language that connects to us. But I'm not sure we're going to ever do that to the official holy text.
Thanks for that. Well, there's no more hands up on the board. I've actually got a probably left field question for me, but then again, that's me. I'm a longtime member, nicely middle of the road. And what's really fascinating is your journey, a non-alcoholic joining us from a religious background. You know what I mean? Banging. But I suppose what I find in my life today is it's not so much people in AA. It's the people out there. You know, you're a walking example in a way to say, hey, this program is good for everybody, right? Because you're not an alcoholic, right?
Right.
And have you seen or is there anything going on? Because I've got four young sons. Well, not four young sons, four young men. And this is a program for living. But as a father, right, I don't want to go to them in that sort of preachy bullshit way that they'll all go, oh, dad's fucking getting on his pulpit. Oh, they switch off. Have you seen any good literature or any good stuff on how to take this program into the real world? And specifically, I would relate it to my issue that I've been thinking about a lot lately. I've got four young men who are about to embark in the world. And there's so much value in this program. They're not alcoholics. You know what I mean? So it's not like, hey, lads, I'll come over to AA. Yeah, you know what I mean? Because that'd be too weird. But some way of somehow, I don't know, communicating it to them that's in a non-preachy way. Have you seen a good book or a some member, are there meetings around this that, you know what I mean, are starting to be created, that it's just about living, taking this and extracting it, take away the addiction element for a little way, and just say, this is just a really good way to look at life, run your life this way, in a certain way, and progress, not perfection. You see what
right.
I mean? And,
right. No. Well, two things. I have a daughter who lives in New York. She's single. She's wonderful. And when I'm up and we have the meeting at the board meeting, we have an AA meeting, and she loves to come with me. So as she says, it's time for my annual AA meeting. She loves it. And she knows this. She sort of knows the steps, and she sort of, but she's not a part of a group that shares at that level. And that's the other thing I would say. It's going to be really challenging. I mean, I really think the world needs this program, and it needs it as a transformation program, not just for addiction, but or maybe all the kinds of other addictions that we have. And of course, there are all those programs out there, Gamblers Anonymous, NA, and so on. But when we realize the key to the level of fellowship in this program is that true mutuality, that shared pain of going to hell and back. That's not going to happen everywhere. It's just not going to happen everywhere. In the church, I ran small group programs that were 22 weeks at a time and 8 people in the group. And there was some significant and very deep sharing and transformation of people's lives through that. I mean, and we even ran one on the 12 steps, two weeks per step, myself and a member of the fellowship. And it made a huge difference, but I don't know that it's going to become a movement. I think the ability to share at a level of true mutuality is just challenging. And it's a sorrow, but I can't fix it. And I think there are places that it's happening, but there's certainly no movement like AA for the healing of our world.
Thanks for that. Joe, I missed Mary. I think she's gone off the meeting. I don't know what happened there. Apologies. So, but Joe, if you want to come on and come on down.
I'm in a new place with a beautiful view and Wi-Fi poverty, so this will improve my message. Just to answer the question you didn't answer, Ward, Ward's book is a great book to give someone that explains AA from a non-preachy point of view, because he's not an alcoholic. He's not a member. He doesn't have the skin in the game that some of us do. And it's a beautiful gift to us. All of our non-alcoholic trustees are beautiful gifts to us. And I just got to know Manny Mendikai, who's a non-alcoholic trustee for the Great Britain General Service Office. And he spent his Sunday night, he's got young kids on Zoom talking to me, right? You know, some Joe he doesn't know from Toronto, you know, and where would we be without our non-alcoholic trustees? Because they're objective. Now, steps. I find the traditions way more sophisticated and brilliant, and almost an AA creation. There isn't an original idea in them, but you know, where the steps are all ideas that were borrowed from psychology, religion, and other places. Like there's nothing, you don't read anything in the steps and go, oh, I never thought of that, never heard of that. But the traditions are the idea of creating a organization with no leadership structure, giving groups the autonomy to be anti-AA, anti the program, anti each other, and having no, you know, organization that can cut them off. That's the brilliance of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think. Can you speak a little bit about your thoughts on the traditions, and even just pick one, if you like, that you think is particularly remarkable? Thanks, Ward. And if I had a God, I would be very mad at him right now. Thanks for sharing about your Parkinson's. It breaks my heart. We've been through a lot together, and here we go again, right?
Right, here we go again. You bet. And that we go is really wonderful. Thank you. I agree. The traditions, while they maybe not be totally original, they really are unique when you put the 12 together. Have a piece that I get very anxious that people are trying to organize AA. I think that it should not be organized and not hire professionals. And the General Service Office talks about being at the bottom of the triangle, but they really would like to be in charge. And it's a constant struggle. And one of my roles as a trustee emeritus is to remind them that AA is to be unorganized and that it really operates at the local level, and everything else is sort of secondary. I get one of the most astounding traditions is seven, that would be self-supporting, and the way that gets interpreted. I have spent 47 years working with this fellowship, and they won't take my money. I'm not a member because I don't have a desire to stop drinking. I still have a drink every month or two, particularly at a football game. But other than that, you know, I'm not a member, and so they're not taking my money. They won't take my money. It's amazing. And the restrictions on how much people can give. There's a real sense of the danger of wealth in this fellowship that I think is very, very healthy. Anonymity. I think we still continue to struggle with anonymity. I'm not sure the Jack Anderson's article in Look magazine would be published today. I think we would think that's not anonymous enough. So I get a little frustrated that the fellowship doesn't say anonymity is not about talking with your priest, with your lawyer, with your doctor. It's about going on the radio and saying how wonderful I am. It's about press or TV, internet, and putting yourself up as somehow special. And we need to be, and I guess that's a piece of this fellowship getting known better in the world, is we need to be open in conversations. I would ask the question, you know, if we're not open, are we living in shame? And people do. I mean, I often just say I'm a trustee at AA, and people automatically assume I'm alcoholic, and that's fine. I wouldn't be ashamed of that. In fact, if it had worked for me, I'm sure I would have been. I tried. It just didn't work for me. I was a significantly abusive drinker in my last 2 years of college and all 3 years in the seminary, Episcopal seminary, you know, we drank. But it just didn't work for me. It didn't work. It didn't do for me what I didn't feel good because I was drinking. I had a good time with people, but that was it. Anyway, if it had worked, I would never have been a Class A trustee. But we re- anonymity, I think we need to be really clearer about than we are. I do think it is the fundamental principle that equalizes all of us. And I think that's kind of interesting that the traditions are bound between unity is important and anonymity is important. And I think those two are two different sides of the same coin. Anyway, I could go on and on, but we're going to run out of time here.